What are Robert Quinlan and his wife feebly arguing about when the homeless man slips quietly in? Moments later, Robert could hardly have said, Obamacare or quinoa or their granddaughter's new boyfriend. Something.
Today on Arts and Letters, we'll be talking with Pulitzer Prize-winning author of over 20 books, Robert Olin Butler.
He and Darla are sitting at a table in the dining area of the New Leaf Co-op. Her back is to the man. Robert is facing him. He notices him instantly, though the man is making eye contact with none of the scattered few of them, the health-conscious members of the co-op, dining by the pound from the hot buffet.
A life in letters, the varied novels, the wildly inventive short stories, the radical pedagogy. A retrospective on the life and times of Robert Olin Butler, in his own words. From the studios of KUAR in Little Rock, I'm J. Bradley Minnick, and welcome to Arts and Letters, a program providing opportunities for the celebration of the arts and humanities.
It's a chilly North Florida January twilight, but he's still clearly overbundled, perhaps from the cold drilling deeper into his bones because of a life lived mostly outside, or perhaps he simply needs to carry all his clothes around with him. Robert takes him for a veteran.
Today we'll be chronicling a career, an archive of experiences in writing, in teaching writing, and in dreaming, as we talk with Pulitzer Prize-winning author Robert Olin Butler about his many books, informed by theories on desire, life's chance meetings, and conscious decisions that inform sometimes unconscious occurrences in the world.
The man's shoulder-length hair is shrapnel gray. His face is deep-creased and umbered by street life. But in spite of the immediately apparent state of his present situation, he stands straight with his shoulders squared. He sits down at a table beside the partition doorway, which gapes into the crosswise aisle between checkout counters and front entrance. He slumps forward ever so slightly and puts both his clenched fists on the tabletop. He stares at them.
A Life in Letters with Robert Olin Butler on Arts and Letters. Author, Pulitzer Prize winner, Robert Olin Butler, welcome.
Great to be here, Brad.
Let's talk about your career, because what I find fascinating is your sense of the dream state in writing.
Yeah.
And the first five books that you wrote, were they in the third person?
The first five books that I published were in the third person, yes.
Right.
The five number is interesting since you're interested in my career. And in some ways, my career began on November 11th, 1981, with the publication day of my very first novel. And I'm one of those fortunate writers in that the first novel that I have published was the first novel that I wrote that deserved to be published.
And that the name of that one was?
That was The Alleys of Eden.
The dogs had fled. The alleys were quiet because the rockets had fallen on Saigon until the dogs had stopped barking at them and felt the terror of the people and joined the refugees rushing out of the city into nowhere. Cliff imagined it this way. He had a vision of the alley outside his window as the center from which they all rushed. Like all matter in the universe rushing from the center in the Big Bang. But he knew this didn't fit. The refugees were pressing into Saigon, pressing into all the corners and cracks and awaiting the end. Maybe a dog would yet bark tonight.
However, prior to that publication, over the years, I wrote a dozen god-awful full-length plays. I have a grad student who put my papers in order, and so we have an exact count. I wrote 44 dreadful short stories, and I wrote five terrible unpublished novels, a million words of dreck. Before, indeed, you mentioned the dream word, something turned in me, and I began to look in the right place in myself to create actual works of art, which is not the rational analytical faculties, as often mistakenly believed by most of my students when they first come to me, by the way, but rather from the place where you dream.
And it had come to Cliff's father at last. Cliff sat at his bedside, and it was night. The table lamp was on, and his father had closed his eyes. Cliff wondered if he was dead. After months, dead. After his father had spoken again and again, the request to his 14-year-old son to kill him, end this pain.
Not your actual dreams, but the place where you dream, or nearby. Your artistic unconscious.
Dreams. Dreams since. His father died a month later, but Cliff was not there. He'd never done his father's bidding, and his father left at last without him, without warning. Cliff had wanted to be there. He imagined his father's hand groping across the bed for him as the end came. The hand on him would forgive him once and for all. No need now, my son. Forget what I asked. I can handle this myself, after all.
That book was finally from there. But the other stuff did not get published. And that's part of the career, too. The working through in a kind of autodidactic way. I didn't have me to tell me this. You have to just get that stuff out of your system. But I didn't know where I was looking in myself initially. And yes, the five first published books, which in retrospect, I think that's what you're asking about, were all written in the third person.
Did you write in grade school and high school?
Yes. I've saved a lot of stuff at this point, but a very major American university has purchased my papers. And what they bought includes a written and illustrated cartoon magazine. It's actually a graphic novel, if you want to, I mean, strictly speaking, called The Hard Bullet, which I did when I was about 5 years old. And so I went back that far. And also my first actual written short story in words, though I did draw a little dogfight of a MiG-15 and an F-86 and over the title page. It was called 23 Flights. And it's about an American fighter pilot in Korea that I wrote in the fifth grade.
23 Flights. My name is Bill O'Connors. I fly an F-86 Sabre for the U.S. Air Force. This was my 23rd flight since my papers came through. I had no action whatsoever so far, and I was itching for excitement. I was to fly over enemy lines about 100 miles and take pictures of enemy installations. The mission was dangerous, so I was equipped with guns along with my cameras. Bill Harkins, my flight leader, slapped me on the back, handed me my map with a red line showing me my route, and said,
"Good luck, and be careful."
One of the crucial things then in that whole process we're talking about, we need to back up to the autobiographies, as I'm telling it, is that, remember those 12 awful full-length plays? Back up even further, I went to Northwestern University in the fall of 1963 wanting to be an actor. That was my first ambition. I had a lot of success as an actor in high school, and my dad was the chairman of the theater department at St. Louis University. Grew up in a kind of theatrical family. He was a wonderful stage director. And I had great success in my first year as a freshman at Northwestern University, which was a legendary theater school. I was actually in four really good roles, and several of them, four of the six major productions in my freshman year. Middle of my sophomore year, I decided I really wanted to write the words more than interpret them. So I shifted into another discipline that was then called oral interpretation, which you can ask about later if you want. It's wonderful. No longer exists in that form. A wonderful way inspiring writers to matriculate in literature. But I then went off to the University of Iowa to get a master's degree in playwriting. And the reason I was such a terrible playwright, I should have known better, is that my most impassioned writing was going into the stage directions. Now, that's a bad sign for a playwright. That is a closeted fiction writer, is what that is. And at the end of my stay at Iowa, my student deferment vanished, and I ended up being drawn into the U.S. Army in February of 1969.
Cliff thought of his own death, no one else's, his own alone. But not in an alleyway, not fallen from the door of a helicopter over the South China Sea, unloaded from the evacuating party by a Marine guard, not in the darkest pit of an army prison. Lee's hovered close to him, but he thought of the death he imagined in his first days in Vietnam. They were days in the countryside, learning the intelligence distribution route, days passing in an open jeep through the little villages around Homestead, days following the hot, quiet country roads, his stomach tight with fear. He was afraid, but at the same time, he felt a simple, undeniable freedom.
And I went into a counterintelligence special agent. That was my MOS. I was in military intelligence. And then the Army sent me to language school for a year. I studied the Vietnamese language for a full year, full time, with a native speaker. It's a tricky language. It's a tonal language, and it's hard for Westerners, but I was able to pick it up. And the reality was that in my first day in Vietnam, I was already speaking fluent Vietnamese. On my second day in Vietnam, I fell madly, deeply in love with Vietnam, with the Vietnamese people, with the culture, with the history of it, the landscape. I spent 5 months working in intelligence out in the countryside, close contacts with Vietnamese fishermen, provincial police chiefs, farmers, woodcutters. Then the unit stood down. This was calendar year 1971 when I was there, and Nixon was starting to bring some units home after having artificially extended the war for 3 years. And my unit went home, but I owed the Army 7 more months in Vietnam, and I had endeared myself to an American diplomat in Saigon who was the advisor to the mayor of Saigon. And he grabbed me up and made me his administrative assistant and sometimes translator. I lived in an old French hotel in Saigon.
Saigon. He wanted to stay in Saigon. Maybe they'd let him stay. But his propaganda value would be nil. He knew that. The war was almost over. Nonetheless, for the moment, he set that aside. How could he be sure? Maybe he could stay. Saigon was his home now. He felt that strongly. He loved this city, for its energy, for its life, moment to moment.
And for 7 months, virtually every night, after midnight, I would go out and wander alone into the steamy back alleys of Saigon where nobody ever seemed to sleep. I was armed only with the Vietnamese language. And I would just go wander the streets of back alleys and crouch in doorways with people. And the Vietnamese people were very warm and generous-spirited people. They invited me into their homes, into their culture, into their lives. And I was 26 years old. In my second month in Vietnam, I got a Dear John letter from my then wife, my first wife. Oh, wow. I was an only child. I was alone in Vietnam in a war that had no front lines, but speaking the language fluently. And I was in a kind of unique position, needless to say, and ready to be adopted. And the Vietnamese people adopted me, man. They took me into their homes and made me part of themselves.
This is Arts and Letters. We're talking to Pulitzer Prize-winning novelist Robert Olin Butler, discussing falling in love with the language and landscape of Vietnam. We'll be back in a moment. This is Arts and Letters. Let's return to our conversation with Pulitzer Prize-winning author Robert Olin Butler.
So we're in Vietnam. We're all by ourselves.
We are indeed.
And were you writing then?
Yeah, but I was still writing plays. I hadn't really come to my senses about all that. Mm-hmm. I actually wrote a play or two in Vietnam while I was there. In one of those plays, some of what was kind of deposited in that play ultimately presented itself over again, almost a decade later, when I wrote The Alleys of Eden.
Sunday, the shop still sealed behind metal grids, the concrete cool around him, a few fruit sellers spreading their mangoes and papayas and jackfruits and shaking the stiffness from their limbs, young Vietnamese couples walking through, their eyes wide in the shade and in their love, and from inside a shop where faint music, Vietnamese classical music, whining and thumping like an Ozark hoedown.
So I got out of the Army and had, from Vietnam, I had sent out resumes, and I got one reply out of all of them. No, two, Doubleday. And I went and interviewed there, and it was like $100 a week to live in New York City. And the other one was with Fairchild Publications, but I didn't realize they weren't really much of a – they published some books, but they were really a business newspaper publisher, which had escaped my attention. And yet a wonderful guy, editor-in-chief then of a guy named Jim Lydon of a weekly business newspaper, which was a hard-nosed investigative newspaper – real newspaper in the electronics business. He brought me in for an interview, I guess out of sympathy for a Vietnam vet. And somehow I convinced him, or he saw it in me. He made me a reporter and actually a section chief on the electronic news. And I had to invent myself. I'd never had a journalism class in my life. And so I became a reporter for electronic news. There's a little back and forth bit, but I've spent essentially 3 years doing that. And then after 3 years of that, Fairchild was about, is the middle of the energy crisis, middle of the 70s, 73, right. 4. Fairchild decided to create a newspaper, a weekly, hard-nosed business newspaper of their model. They publish Women's Wear Daily, by the way, is what they're most famous for. That would be written for people in businesses who are trying to conserve and manage energy. The publisher of, and I was now working, I say a little bit of the back and forth, I was in Chicago working in the Chicago Bureau for electronic news. I was their Midwest reporter. And the publisher who was going to oversee the new energy paper was my publisher at Electronic News. And so I just sat down again. And in retrospect, I realized I invented a first-person voice of a crackerjack editor of a business newspaper. I wrote a 1,000-word short story to my publisher telling him why I should be the creator and editor of this business newspaper. And by golly, they hired me, brought me to New York, gave me a desk and a blank check and said, invent this newspaper for us and populate it with investigative reporters. And I did. I eventually had 19 reporters who – and they were kind of tight-fisted. We had low budgets. I would hire people straight out of J school in Columbia or wherever for $9,600 a year. And I would teach them investigative journalism techniques that I learned – either made up myself or imagined out of my compost heap or figured out in the 3 years I'd reported for electronic news and teach them. And we had a hell of a newspaper. And we had a couple of stories that were picked up by 60 Minutes, and it was kind of interesting. I spent a decade doing that.
And it probably really helped your writing.
In retrospect, I realized I was working on the skills that eventually found their way in. But I still wrote bad. I mean, I started writing fiction, and I wrote those 5 terrible novels in those 13 years. But then I started writing really well.
When did that happen? When did you feel you started writing well?
1979, I think, I started writing The Alleys of Eden. And at that point, I was commuting on the Long Island Railroad every day into Manhattan to be the editor of Energy User News. And had a baby son, and the only time I really had to write if I was going to be a writer was on the train. And that's what I did. I started writing. This was before laptops. My laptop was a Masonite lap board. I wrote 300 polished words going in and 300 polished words going home. That was my quota, and I did that. And finally, I started writing good books. I wrote The Alleys of Eden on my lap on the Long Island Railroad.
The bright sun, the dark earth ditches, the dirt clods at hand, a stand of trees, the smell of earth and heat, the feel of the road.
And then they started coming.
They did. Oh. I did my first 5 novels, The Alleys of Eden, Sundogs, Countrymen of Bones, On Distant Ground, and Wabash were all written in the third person.
Right.
The 6th novel, however, was my transition toward that deeper layer of my compost heap. Because I wrote a book called The Deuce, and that was published in 1989.
I wish it was simple just to say who I am. just to say, my name is so-and-so. And that makes you think of a certain kind of person that would be me. I think of other names, and there's no doubt about there being faces with them.
And it was in the first person, and it was in the voice of a half Vietnamese, half American, former Saigon street kid. At some point, the American Army officer who was his father went back and got him, took him from his Vietnamese bar girl mother and brought him back to Point Pleasant, New Jersey to let him be an American. And at age 16, he reads about a Vietnamese community in Montreal and he decides, I'm a deuce, I'm two things, and I don't, and I want to be that thing.
But me, I've got three names. And so I've got to go through all this bull just to start talking. I'm Anthony James Hatcher, Tony, I'm Bud Din Tun, and I'm the Deuce. Don't ask me which one I'd use. It's too early for that. I've got to tell you some things first.
So that was the transition book. But there were six actual critically acclaimed novels in the decade of the 80s.
But they didn't sell that well.
Well, that's the definition. And right. I used a more vigorous term, which I will not use here on public radio. But the definition of a critically acclaimed novel is they get nice reviews, but they don't sell jack.
Right.
And that was so true of these books. And, of course, I made a great career move at that point then because my Stat 6 novel, The Deuce, had a major Sunday New York Times book review rave about it on publication day from Scott Spencer, wonderful novelist. Right. It went on to get five more reviews in 1989, which means it was totally ignored. It sold a total of 1,086 copies. It's Simon & Schuster, which means it sold nothing because 1,086 copies fall off trucks and get counted as sales. So that's where I was. Wow. My editor got fired, not just because of that book, and for no good reason. He was a brilliant literary editor, and maybe that was the real reason. His name is Alan Peacock. He went over to Henry Holt, and the first book he bought at Henry Holt, and the first book I wrote after a decade of declining sales to almost nothing. What a shrewd move we both made, because books of short stories are classically, I think to this day, felt by publishers to be anathema because that's the vanity book you give to your big author because they're waiting for your novel or it's between novels. And it was 1989, and actually political identity consciousness, you know, identity politics consciousness was even beginning back then. So my next move and his next move, let's publish a book of short stories in the voices of Vietnamese men and women.
I read this now while I'm hidden in the storage shack, invisible, soaked with sweat like it's that time in Saigon between the dry season and the rainy season. And I know my father will be here soon. The lawnmower is over there in the corner, and this morning he got up and said that it was going to be hot today, that there were no clouds in the sky, and he was going to have to mow the lawn. When he opens the door, I will let him see me here, and I will ask him to talk to me like in these letters, like when he was so angry with some stranger that he knew what to say.
And we published it in the year when All the Pretty Horses was going to win the Pulitzer Prize, and it didn't.
Did you know when you were writing Good Scent from a Strange Mountain that you had something special?
Of course I knew. It was like I wasn't even writing it. I was possessed. I think I've already established my cred for being able to write in the voices of Vietnamese people. They adopted me. They parented me. They taught me not just about them, but about the human condition, about the human heart. And I grew up for 18 years. It was 18 years between then and Good Scent. So, I mean, I've spent a childhood through adolescence living with them in my unconscious before they began to speak. And I'm saying they began to speak. And it's an interesting thing. If you want to know why it happened, it's kind of an interesting life lesson. You don't automatically be a great short story writer. And so I was convinced, once I started publishing well and being critically acclaimed, that I was a novelist. And I, you know, just like Raymond Carver never really could write a novel, I wasn't going to be able to write short stories fine. Well, critically acclaimed. It's true. I mean, by the time I published my fifth novel, Wabash, I don't think I'd ever seen a bad review or even a mediocre review.
When Wabash Steel had orders and there was work, the fine black soot from the mill lay on the porch steps each morning like an overnight snow. Deborah Cole was sweeping it away on a June morning in 1932 when her mother appeared before her, panting, saying,
"Come on now, hon. Maybe you can help me with Aunt Berenice."
Deborah looked into the tree. 10 feet up, Aunt Berenice sat, straddling a limb that looked too thin to hold her. She was wearing a flower print house dress, which she tucked modestly around her legs that dangled down with 1 foot slippered, 1 foot bare.
Wabash came out, and all the other reviews were great, but I got my first terrible review, and it was very public. And it was done by a guy named Alan Chuse. He was the NPR book reviewer, this very NPR. And it couldn't have been more public. And so I had my first literary enemy. And at the time, I was teaching creative writing, finally. It had just started, really, at McNeese State University in Lake Charles, Louisiana. And I was, for 15 years, I was a one-person gig. And one thing I did also as the one-person shop was I had a budget every year to bring in, I guess, 3 or 4 writers who would come. We were living in southwestern Louisiana, in the middle of Cajun country. I'd put them up in the back room of my house and show them a good time take them out in the bayous. And this was in between Wabash and the Deuce. All right, I looked myself in the mirror one day. I said, "Is this who you really are?" Because I'd been stewing. Hardly a day went by, and there were some nights I'd wake up arguing with Alan Chuse in my mind. And you go, "Is this who you really want to be? You're going to have more of this. You're not just book critics. It's in your life. Is this really who you want to be?" And I said, "Nah, I don't think I do." So I knew that Alan Chuse was also a novelist and not getting the acceptance that I'm sure he wanted. So I figured out what Alan Schuss's phone number was, and I called Alan Schuss. "Hello, Alan. This is Robert Owen Butler." Gulp. "Hello." I said, "Hey, man, listen, I just want you to know I'm, big fan of your fiction. I'm the fiction guy at McNeese State University. I'd love to pay you X number of dollars to come down here. I'll put you up. I'll show you a good time in Cajun country. You can talk to my students. You've got a lot of reading under your belt. You know some things they want to know, and you can read from your novel and talk about that." Okay, sure. I brought Alan Chuse down, gave him a hug at the airport, showed him a hell of a good time. Wabash never came up between us. We became good buds, gave him a hug at the airport, goodbye, and I went, okay. 6 months later, I get a phone call from Alan Chuse. "Hello, Bob. It's Alan Chuse." "Hi, Alan. How you doing, guy?" "Doing good." He says, "Listen, man, I'm producing a show for NPR called The Sound of Writing, and we're commissioning short stories from writers that we like, and we're going to have a professional actor read that story on the air. John Updike's given us a story. Ann Beattie's giving us a story. Would you give us a story?" I said, "You bet, Alan." And I went back at that point and read some of my old stories, hoping I'd find, they seemed worse than I ever remembered them. But I slept on it the next day. At that point, I was already in the midst of writing The Deuce. And there was a little bit of Vietnamese folkway that I had picked up hanging around the back alleys of Saigon or maybe in the broad daylight. And I thought it was going to get into The Deuce, but I realized it wasn't, or it didn't have to. And it suddenly, as soon as I looked at the note about it in my notes for The Deuce, boing, what it was is that there's little boys in Vietnam. They love to catch, train, and fight crickets. And as soon as I saw that note, all of a sudden, in my head, I heard a guy's voice. And the guy was a Vietnamese father in exile. And, now we're talking 12 years after South Vietnam fell and the boat people happened. And there were some Vietnamese in Lake Charles, were a lot of them in New Orleans. And I got to New Orleans a lot. And anyway, I heard his voice in my head. He was trying to convince on a boring Sunday afternoon in Lake Charles, trying to convince his 11-year-old son, born in America, thoroughly Americanized, trying to get him interested in cricket fighting.
Did you want to do something fun?
Sure, Pop. So what you got, Pop?
Fighting crickets.
What?
I sat down. I wrote that story in one sitting. And 6.5 hours later, I had this short story. And damn, it was good.
Listen, you need to understand that if you are to have fighting crickets, there are two types. One type we call the charcoal crickets. The other types were small and brown, and we called them fire crickets. They weren't as strong, but they were very smart and quick.
So who would win?
Sometimes one and sometimes the other.
Sounds neat.
I went to bed that night. I woke up the next morning, and I had 2 dozen more stories to write. All those voices started crowding into my head. And
you became the person you wanted to be. Do you think that's what, in some ways, allowed this?
Yeah, it probably allowed, you're right, I hadn't thought of it that way, is right. It probably opened up the path to that deeper level of my unconscious. Absolutely. If I hadn't let go of my enemy, I would never have written A Good Scent from a Strange Mountain. I probably never would have won a Pulitzer Prize. I wouldn't be sitting here with you today. I wouldn't have met the love of my life, my current wife, and the world would have changed dramatically for the worse. I believe in my bones if I hadn't made that choice to let go of an enemy.
This is Arts and Letters. We're talking with Pulitzer Prize winning novelist Robert Olin Butler. We'll be back in a moment. You're listening to Arts and Letters. Let's return to our conversation with Robert Olin Butler about winning the Pulitzer Prize for his book, A Good Scent from a Strange Mountain.
What was the time span between you published that book and then you learn you win the Pulitzer?
Let me back up first and tell you how the Pulitzer's won. First of all, there is an 18-person, slowly changing Pulitzer Advisory Board. They make the final choices. But there's a yearly rotating 3-person jury in each of the prize areas. So there's 3 people in fiction. We'll just talk about the fiction prize now. 3 people on a fiction jury who choose 3 finalist books. They make their own individual choice. Then they come together and they say, who was your choice? And they name each other. And the only reason they may have to make a committee decision is if 2 of those are the same or all 3 are the same, in which case then they look at their own second choices. And But the first choice goes through. But that's how it's done. And then they go off to the 18-person committee and they decide who wins. Mm-hmm. So let me – okay, now I'll answer your question. In March of 1992 – Henry Holt, in spite of it being a book of short stories by a middle-aged white guy from the Midwest writing in Voices of Vietnamese, they sent me on a 13-city book tour, coast to coast. The first place I went was a lovely literary bookstore in the San Francisco Bay Area, and everybody who read The Deuce showed up, which is to say no one did. I was an immediate member of the Zero Club.
Oh, my gosh.
Then I went off to the Elliott Bay Bookshop in Seattle. They have a fabulous – I mean, their clientele know that there was a reading series man and you're – well, I had 6 people at the Elliott Bay Bookshop on a pretty spring night in March. And there was a lot of red faces around amongst the staff. But you know what? I had another choice to make, a life lesson. I looked at those 6 people, and I'd just been from Zero, and this is my first book tour. And anyway, I said, you know, if it's true that I'm supposed to have 25 or 30 people here just routinely at Elliott Bay, and I've got 6, you 6, I can't tell you how much I appreciate that. I'm going to give you a hell of a show. And of course, I went back to my acting days. I love to read from my work. And so I read my heart out to 6 people, shook all the hands of the book clerks, signed the stock, and went on my way. A year later, I won a Pulitzer with that book. 2 months after that, I came back to Elliott Bay on the Penguin book tour for the paperback. And, you know, I had a couple other people there at Elliott Bay attending. And the guy who ran the reading series came up to me afterwards and said, hey, He says, remember you were here last year? I remember. He says, I thought you'd like to know that the next day, Charles Johnson came in the shop. Now, Charles Johnson, an African-American novelist, brilliant novelist, had won the, prior to that, some years before that, had won the National Book Award for Middle Passage. Yeah. But he was teaching at the time at the University of Washington in Seattle. And he says, Charles Johnson came in the shop, and he said, I heard you had a reading last night. How was it? And he says, oh, my God. He says, it was a terrific reading. It was wonderful. He said, oh, yeah. And he says, I'm sure you have a signed book. Well, sure. And so he says, I just want you to know, Charles Johnson bought your book. That's great. So I went on my rest of my tour. Back then, they weren't as open about it, the Pulitzer Committee. Now, on the day of Internet, everything's open. I eventually, I think it was a year or so later, I found out. My jury, my three-person jury, Ann Tyler chose Alice McDermott's Weddings and Wakes to send for it. Richard Eder, who's a major critic, had chosen Joyce Carol Oates' Blackwater. You know where I'm heading.
And
you know
Charles
who chose
Johnson.
My book?
Charles Johnson.
Charles Johnson. One more time, would I have won a Pulitzer Prize if I hadn't looked at these people and said, man, if you want something from me, I'm going to give it to you.
So you never know.
Don't keep enemies, and you give of yourself to whoever needs you.
Then an interesting career move. You've done well with the Pulitzer.
Oh, yeah.
And then we start writing books that are in not any way similar to.
Oh, well, heavens. You know, yeah.
So we write a book.
I reinvent
Henry
myself.
Miller book.
Yeah.
A book called Tabloid Dreams.
Yeah.
Every man she kisses dies. Because the men I love, the ones who come to me gentle and speak sweetly and take it slow and look me in the eyes and try their hardest to do it right, they all die as it is from the touch of my lips.
And I write a book of 240-word length short stories in the voices of recently severed heads.
Arm around my neck, the king leads me out among my roses, the Thames sliding heavily along, just beyond the rosemary hedge. You never fail me, he says, tugging me closer in the crook of his arm, his breath on my face, smelling of pheasant and ale from my table. Let's speak now of the stars spinning round the earth, he says. And I sit in a palace hall, the king and Catherine the queen beside him, and the plates are of gold, and the servants are back treading softly, and there is not a sound.
I took a wife of mine to Saigon, and we went to the War Crimes Museum and stood before a French guillotine in that War Crimes Museum in Saigon, which had been in thorough use until 1954. And I went, whoa. And it was it being in that its presence. And in terms of voices, a multiplicity of voices, and these would have been Vietnam voices sitting in that box, and in terms of the yearning for an identity, you know, the life passing before your eyes, who am I, who was I? That spun around in me for a few years. Because if you study history, there's a lot of anecdotal evidence out of the French Revolution, cut off a lot of heads, that there's consciousness left. So I invented, and that's another revelation here on your show, two epigraphs, one from a French doctor of the 19th century. It says, after due consideration, it's my impression that there's enough blood left in the brain of a severed head to sustain consciousness for 1.5 minutes. The other epigraph from a handbook of speech saying, you know, in a heightened state of emotion, we speak at the rate of 160 words a minute. So do the math, 160 words a minute, minute and a half, 240 words. I wrote 62 short stories, each of them exactly 240 words long, in the voices of recently severed heads.
Right. I like the one with the voice from Thomas More.
We wait for Henry's hands to open from the fists beside his plate, and the peacocks are before us, their bright plumes vanished, their flesh darkened by the fire, and waiting, the king loosens his right hand and takes up a knife, and he places his left hand on the back of the bird, and the knife comes down, the body comes apart, and he lifts the meat and he says, "Eat." But my hands are folded before me. I am kneeling. I wait. Where now? There is only darkness. Eat. I open my mouth. Corpus Domini Nostri. His arm is round my neck. He twists me to him, his hair a fiery crown. "I am your king," he says. And it is dark again, and I lift my eyes to a body torn. Jesu Christi, the bread on my tongue. I eat, my king.
And I've written Mr. Spaceman.
For the creatures of this planet, there is never any rest. The world they try to leave behind will not let go. It pursues them into the darkest places and unfolds its tent and strings its lights. And it's another opening of another show.
Mr. Spaceman did pretty well.
It did well. Oh, yeah, they do well. And you see, my audiences don't build. Whoever bought They Whisper, they're not going to buy Tabloid Dreams, you know, are very few. Some of them will. They'll say, "My God, what's he done now?" And honestly, the through line in everything I've written is what I feel is the essence of literary fiction. Fiction is the art form of human yearning. That is really about, I yearn for an identity. I yearn for a self. I yearn for a place in the universe. And you will find that at the depth of every book I've written, from They Whisper to Tabloid Dreams to Good Sam from a Strange Mountain to Mr. Spaceman to Hell. I wrote a book set entirely in Hell.
This is Hatcher McCord, anchorman for the evening news from Hell. Hatcher McCord, of course, is very famous. It all has to come back to these ways we exist in our moment-to-moment encounters with consciousness. From hell. Even into eternity. Even if the moments leap and circle and combine, we are all still along for the ride, and we have company. Like the woman who stepped on my foot.
Excuse me.
And we have to figure out how to deal with all that. But Satan won't let me think about not thinking.
To a small hotel, which Oprah magazine called a new old-fashioned romance.
He is draped with Mardi Gras beads. The beads may have changed over the years, but there have always been beads. The French windows are open to a trompe l'oeil balcony, a filigreed iron balustrade from one side of the jam to the other. Nowhere to step outside. Just lean there and look down into the courtyard and out to the hipped and grappled roofs of the quarter. And to the sun, falling toward late afternoon in the western sky before her.
In 3 years, I published 3 books, which are, I insist, literary, but also historical espionage thrillers. And they're all set during World War I.
Christopher Cobb is how I sign my stories. But Christopher Marlowe Cobb is my full name. And my editors right along have all wanted me to use the whole moniker in my byline.
And a series.
Oh, yeah. It's the same narrator, a guy named Christopher Marlowe Cobb, who's an American war correspondent. He first covers America's invasion of Mexico in April of 1914, which is really happening under the radar of American history. Woodrow Wilson, who keeps us out of World War I for ages.
But I find all those three-name newsboys, the William Howard Russells and the Richard Harding Davises and the George Bronson Rays and all the rest, and the host of magazine scribblers and the novelists with three names are just as bad. Well, I think they all make themselves sound pompous and full of self-importance. And it's not as if I don't like the long version of me. My mother gave me the name, after all, when she first laid me newborn in a steamer trunk backstage at the Pelican Theater in New Orleans. And she went on to become one of the great and beautiful stars of the American stage. The eminent, the esteemable, the inimitable Isabel Cobb. And Christopher Marlowe was her favorite. Though he didn't understand women, probably didn't like them, because he never wrote anything like a true heroine in any of his plays. And maybe that tells you something about my mother's taste in men.
We go into Mexico with the army because we didn't like the dictator running the country and to protect American oil interests, which is, turns out, is an old American custom there. And I landed on that event and that voice and that character of that war correspondent because of writing a book called Had a Good Time, right, which is a book of short stories where I had been collecting, again, for, I don't know, 14, 15 years, I've been collecting postcards just for myself. But not so much for the images on the front, but for the messages written on the backs. Yeah. You know, those great little outbursts of most of it's deadly boring, but every once in a while, it's a labor-intensive hobby, reading a lot of old postcards. But interesting things sometimes are said there. And I chose my 15 favorite cards, and we published the front and back of the card, and then I wrote the real story behind what was said there.
My son is a man, too, according to the Selective Service Act. But God help me if I'll let him be a man yet without a fight. This is something I know, like any mother knows. The boy is not fully a man, if I can remember so clearly lifting his wee body up and placing it on a rectangle of cotton, clean from the boiling pot and warm from the sun. And I swaddle him up and hold him against me, and he is gentle and he is quiet. And I carry him away, carry him through the world. And all the while he is taking in the things that I know was his mother as a woman, but cannot say, cannot even put into words except to hold him close and whisper softly to him that he is a good boy. And I love him.
What's beating at the heart of every book, of every central character, of every book I've written, is that great quest. And the reason is, it's the central question of our human condition. Every morning, everybody on this planet wakes up, and if they don't do it in a mirror, they do it virtually. If they don't do it overtly, they do it deeply inside. They look in their mirror and they go, who the hell are you? Who are you? And where do you belong? And all the stuff that we look at in our culture, in our age, in our politics, in our lives, the great issues, the roiling things, gender, race, ethnicity, sexual preference, religion, politics, you name it. Step back from all that stuff. What are those things trying to answer? Who am I? I'm a Muslim. I'm a Sikh. I'm a Jew. I'm a Catholic. I'm a Christian. You know, I'm an atheist. I'm white. I'm black. I'm woman. I'm man. It's all in great pursuit of that deep, deep thing. And that's what the artist does. And that's what works of literature do. Because literature alone as an art form, it's the only one that can represent, that resides in that ongoing interaction between the deep sensibility of the inner life of human beings and the external world. No other narrative form can go there except fiction. And at that deepest level, it's all ontology. You know, who am I in this beingness? Similarly, the fourth comp book I find is being influenced by having written Perfume River. I should feed him, he says low. She blinks and gathers herself. Who? He nods in the vet's direction. She peeks over her shoulder. The man is still pushing his coins gently around. She leans to Robert, lowering her voice. I didn't see him. He just came in, Robert says. Feed him quinoa, Darla says. She isn't kidding. Please, he says, rising. She shrugs. This isn't a thing Robert often does, never with money. He carries the reflex attitude learned in childhood. You give a guy like this money and it will go for drink, which just perpetuates his problems. There are organizations he can find if he really wants to take care of himself. Giving food is another matter, he figures. But to give food to somebody you encounter on the street while rafting the momentum of your daily life, that's usually an awkward thing to pull off. And so, in those rare cases when it wouldn't be awkward, you can easily overlook the chance. But here is a chance he's noticed. And there's something about this guy that continues to suggest veteran. There is in this book what one of the admiring reviews said, a backbeat of suspense in Perfume River. So, you know, what seems like wild diversity is in fact an ongoing dialogue in myself, where the forms of my fiction may shift around on the surface, but down underneath, in the universal human condition and the way it's built upon our yearning for an identity, those things are in every book I write, and those are in a deep dialogue as well with all of the aspects of the human condition that I'm observing in the zeitgeist. And what a zeitgeist we have.
Broadcast from the studios of KUAR in Little Rock, you've been listening to Arts and Letters. Thanks for joining us. To check out past episodes, go to artsandlettersradio.org. Leave us a comment there and let us know what you've thought about the program. Thank you to actors Gary Hinton, Logan Wells, Richard Wells, Tony Fan, Tu Wing, Beth Wells, Lori Pierce, Ree Nguyen, Victor Fan, Ann Owen, Keith Robinson, Trey Philpotts, Terry Wright, Mary Ellen Cubitt, Devin Robertson, and Linda Heyman. Thank you to musician Michael Shackelford and his band Galactic Engineers of Magnetic Sounds. Thank you to harp guitarist extraordinaire Travis Bowman, who supplied the amazing soundtrack for this episode. Thank you to Sticky's Rock and Roll Chicken Shack for keeping music alive and well in Arkansas. Generous funding for Arts and Letters was provided by the Arkansas Humanities Council and the National Endowment for the Humanities. Thank you to writer Robert Olin Butler for such an extraordinary good time, and for dreaming into being so many very disparate worlds and characters, all of whom yearn for that one essential thing, to stand up and shout, "I'm here, I matter, I make a difference." For Arts and Letters, I'm J. Bradley Minnick. Let's heed the words of Graham Greene. A story has no beginning or end. Arbitrarily, one chooses that moment of experience from which to look back or from which to look ahead.